Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Today's conversation is another segment in a series of programs regarding the tearing down of I-81 and the rebuilding and redevelopment of its on-the-ground footprint. My guest today is Lanessa Chaplin. Ms. Chaplin is an attorney and an assistant director at the New York Civil Liberties Union. She's been one of the local leaders who have raised some concerns about what might replace the I-81 area. She participated last April in a panel discussion on I-81 at Syracuse University titled Charting Renewal. You can view that discussion by searching for City Scripts Charting Renewal. Ms. Chaplin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let me start with just a really basic question, if I could, which is simply, who or what decides what is going to replace the I-81 footprint as that highway is torn down and as there's redevelopment underneath it? Who makes that decision?
So I think it's a loaded question, right?
Okay.
Because, I mean, hopefully the people make the decision, right? So that's the goal. The goal is that the community will make that decision on what replaces the I-81 viaduct. However, technically, it's the New York State Department of Transportation, right? So they're the ultimate deciders on what happens to this project, with the caveat, and why I say it's loaded, is because it also needs to be approved by the Federal Highway Administration. So we have a bunch of parties here trying to work together to come to some type of agreement about what should be happening with this viaduct. But the ultimate decision really lies with the Department of Transportation.
So that's, and that applies to what gets rebuilt underneath it then as well. I thought perhaps that might be something that the city had more control over and the mayor, but that's not the case.
So currently, and I think all we have to go by now is the 2019 preliminary draft environmental impact statement, right? And so that's the report that the New York State Department of Transportation put out last summer, or two summers ago in 2019. And so under their current plan, the one that's publicly available, they plan on keeping that land. And so they don't plan on returning it to the city of Syracuse. And so, right. And so right now we're kind of in the standstill where we're saying, well, what are you gonna do with the land if you maintain control over it? And the right thing to do would be to transfer that land over to the city of Syracuse so we can think about how we're going to redevelop that area once the viaduct comes down.
So this is interesting. The plot is thickening for me here. so we've got this organization. It's a nonprofit, Blueprint 15. It was initiated by the Allen Foundation and some other parties in the town, as far as I understand, in the city. And it's been putting forward at least an abstract version of a model or a vision for what will be underneath this, what will replace the area underneath the viaduct. That will ultimately need to be approved then, the way it currently stands, by the state organization and the federal organization that you mentioned. Is that correct?
So I always try to make sure to keep those conversations separate, right? Because
okay.
I do think that people kind of conflate the two issues of New York State Department of Transportation removing the viaduct and then insert Blueprint 15 redeveloping in that area. And they're two totally separate projects. And I like the way I like to put it, and I think the former chapter director, Yusuf Abdul Qadir, said it the best, where these are two trains, right? They're going on the same direction, but they're definitely on different tracks. And one is not dependent on the other. And so even if the viaduct was to remain there, Blueprint would have to figure out how they're going to develop in that area with a major roadway in the middle of their community. But yes, to your point, if they do want to develop on that area of land, that land still belongs to the state. It's not owned by the city yet. And so that negotiation power would have to go through the state and Blueprint 15. Otherwise, they would have to join the train of folks who are saying, you need to be supporting the city receiving that land back and let the community decide what they want to do with it. I think it's a very dangerous kind of lane you're in when you're thinking about negotiating with the state to be able to access some land that hasn't been first yet proposed to the public to say how they want to develop it.
Okay, so then let me pose one possibility then. Let's say that leaders in the city become concerned about what Blueprint 15 is putting forward, do they then go to those state agencies and say, we'd like it to look this way? What is the ability of city leaders, let's say the mayor or the county leader, the county executive, to influence this process? It doesn't sound like then Blueprint 15, quote unquote, must go through that level of governance to do its development. Is that right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think the city of Syracuse and other city leaders have a lot of say in what happens to that land, because ultimately they are stakeholders in the project. Right. And that gives them a certain legal right. And so because this is a New York State Department of Transportation project, however, the city of Syracuse, the county of Onondaga, and other participating partners are stakeholders, right? And so they have the right to weigh in on what should be happening to this land. So if the city, for example, said, we don't like the idea of Blueprint and we don't want this to develop on this land, they should absolutely convey that message to the DOT, and the DOT has to consider it because they are stakeholders in the project.
Okay. I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and I'm speaking with Lanessa Chaplin, Assistant Director at the New York Civil Liberties Union, and we're talking about the development of the I-81 area in Syracuse. Okay, this has helped clarify things for me quite a bit. So let's focus then on the Blueprint 15, because that is kind of the model that's out there right now for what's going to happen underneath the viaduct, and with the assumption that this highway does come down, which it looks like that is going to happen. So that I think is relatively in place at this point. How would you describe then? So there's going to need to be a process of talking about Blueprint 15. And so how would you describe the process of integrating public input and needs in the planning process so far for what's going to happen on the ground?
Are you referring to describe the Blueprint 15 process or describing the DOT process?
Okay, fair enough. Let's say the Blueprint 15. Let's focus on that, because in my understanding, that is the only kind of overarching plan for a redevelopment of what's on the ground that is currently out there and being put forward. Maybe you want to comment on that first, but so let's focus on Blueprint 15 for that reason.
Okay, so I mean, what I would say is, so the New York Civil Liberties Union, we drafted a report, Building Better Futures. And, in our proposal, we're saying that some of them parcels of land, specifically the 8 acres of land that is just west of MLK Boulevard, should be reserved as a community land trust. And so we are asking for that land to be reserved as a community land trust, something similar that has happened in other states. You know, Albany has a land trust in Ithaca and Washington, D.C. and some other parts of New York City. And we're saying that land trust should be preserved for the community to decide how they want to develop on that land. So I think we have different ideologies of what should be happening on that land as compared to what Blueprint 15 has. Although I do have to say, I don't know the nuts and bolts of what Blueprint 15's plan is enough to say this is their comprehensive plan. I don't know if they've actually developed the comprehensive plan outside of redeveloping Syracuse Public Housing Authority, which again will happen regardless of what happens to the I-81 viaduct, right? So their footprint is the Pioneer Home, Central Village, in other areas of that public housing authority in that footprint. And that's going to happen. I don't wanna say it's gonna happen no matter what, because there's always an option for people not to want that and to do things to make sure that they don't get that project if it's not something the community wants. And hopefully, you know, Blueprint 15 will respect those decisions of those community members if they don't want that project in their community. But as far as I know, the land that will become available or vacant as a result of the viaduct coming down has not been decided who's going to develop on that land. Some of the initiatives that we have been pushing for as an organization is putting a pressure on the city of Syracuse to say, whatever goes on this land, and there needs to be some assurances that the community that lives there is not going to be pushed out. For example, we commented on the rezone plan. One of the cautionary tales is making sure that available land stays affordable. So like any kind of development that happens on that community needs to have inclusive zoning, which means every building that's built there has to have affordable housing. But also we want to kind of carve out places where the community can start to build their own equity. So it's not enough just to say we need to provide affordable housing, we also need to be able to provide opportunities for people, people to be able to build equity, whether that's through home ownership or starting a small business. That's the type of usage that we would like to see when the viaduct comes down. We would like to see community-led, Black-led, Black-owned businesses, homeowner opportunities, affordable housing built on that, along with obviously mixed use and mixed income, but it needs to be done in an equitable way. That's what we're asking for, apart from the City of Syracuse initiatives or Blueprint 15's initiatives. Those are the ways that I think as an organization, we see that land being best used to kind of combat some of the, all of the things that we know to be true in the City of Syracuse. Like, we need to start addressing the racial injustices, we need to start addressing the inequities, we need to start addressing the very real segregation that this community has. And the only way we're really going to do that is start being intentional about it and naming it for what it is. And so those are some of the things that we're looking for. I haven't done enough research on Blueprint 15 to say that they are aligned with what we are seeking to do. Also, I haven't done enough research on Blueprint 15 to know if they're going to actually try to occupy some of that developable land. From what I know, they are just kind of focusing on Syracuse Housing Authority, but also wanting to uplift that community needs to be fully in charge of what happens to their community. A lot of folks who live there that we've spoken to over the past 3 years are really tethered to that community. They've been there for years and generations. They love and appreciate their community. And we just have to be mindful that when we're talking about a redevelopment plan, we are talking about disrupting people's lives, right? And I think it's easy to say that we can disrupt people's lives for the greater good in the future. It's easy to say that when you're not the person being disrupted.
You have brought up several different lines of concern that I want to explore in greater depth in the second half of the program. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Lanessa Chaplin, an attorney and an assistant director at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Last April, she took part in a Syracuse University panel titled Charting Renewal, about housing, redevelopment, social justice, and the replacement of I-81 in Syracuse. You can find that discussion by searching for CityScripts Charting Renewal. So let me get into a couple of the things that you brought up before the break and the distinctions that you've been making between Blueprint 15 and the process as a whole and who has the land, I think are extremely helpful here. Let me take Blueprint 15 just for one moment and then we'll get into a more general discussion. But my understanding of the plan is that it hasn't been put forward in great detail yet, but it is a mixed income, mixed use kind of redevelopment vision, similar to the purpose-built communities that have been done elsewhere that Blueprint 15 is obviously tied to. And there are some concerns that have come up from where those projects have been done elsewhere that I want to get into. But first of all, Blueprint 15 as a process is entering a different phase according to their website. So on its website, it labels the last 5 years as a pre-planning stage, planning work, assembling the team, kind of like, in my view, the silent phase of a fundraising campaign. And then now we have in the 2 months that we've just entered in May and June of this year, is the listening phase to understand the needs of the residents. And then there's another 2 month period following that, July and August, the testing phase to test ideas for housing and the neighborhood with residents. So that's their schedule for the public input just on Blueprint 15. I understand your point that there will be other opportunities for public input more generally, but that's for Blueprint 15. I'm just wondering, do you think meaningful public input could be collected and integrated in a 4 months period of time, starting in May, starting this month? That seems a bit compressed to me. What's your sense of that?
You know, Grant, I tend to agree with you. I think it's going to be especially hard to meet the type of numbers that they would need to meet. One, because we're still in the middle of a pandemic. So we kind of have to be mindful that we're still in the middle of a pandemic and people are still not gathering in large groups. And some people are pretty still cautionary, right, to kind of participate in public activities. So keeping that in mind, I would say it's a aspirational goal of theirs. And I would hope that if they don't meet those markers in 2 months, they continue to extend those phases as necessary.
Okay. And the other thing I noticed when I went on their website was that there was no contact information for any individuals. There was a generic email box to communicate with. You have a lot of experience with community organizations and the way that they communicate. What do you make of that? Is that a red flag, would you say?
What I would say is it definitely takes additional effort to connect to frontline communities. I think the typical kind of communicating that you would find in a, you know, more resourced community are just not going to work in this community. This community has a lot of distrust between state actors, government actors, and also organizations. And so there's gonna have to be a lot of trust building that's going to require direct, in-person, one-on-one phone call contacts. They're gonna have to build that bridge of trust. And I just don't think it's there right now in the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to be frank with you, I'm a native of Syracuse, I'm from here. And I still needed to spend a lot of time in that specific community to gain trust. And probably I still don't have full trust. I don't want to, you know, appear that I have full trust, but it's still a work in progress 3 years later. And so It can take a lot of work and a lot of personal effort, and not impossible to do, but you're right that having, you know, an email on a website is not enough. And I'm not saying that to say that that's all they have. I mean, they do have a community development director, and I do believe they're hiring other staff, but I would say that alone, no, is not enough to, you know, kind of connect those dots that you need to connect to engage the community.
So let's generalize this then and just put aside Blueprint 15 specifically, but more generally, efforts to redevelop areas like the one under I-81. It is the experience elsewhere that mixed use and mixed income redevelopments have received criticism for pushing out the poorest residents during the transition. And you spoke to that in the first half of the program, and also the fact that in any case, people are being displaced, and this is jarring for families, and particularly for families that are more challenged in the first place and more disadvantaged. So when you look at other places, the percentages of people that come back can be quite low. And even though, again, not to bring Blueprint 15 specifically back into it, but in the purpose-built community in Atlanta, the number was about 15%. So that's quite low. So in your understanding then, what are the ways in which this happens? What is the mechanisms through which people either are pushed out or don't come back?
Well, first I want to say, I couldn't agree more that there are controversies that follow almost every purpose-built community. And it always ties back into the community's right to return, right? This kind of idea that there's an automatic right to return. And it always goes back to the amount of apartments that are available. So those are the kind of the two biggest criticisms that we've seen in other purpose-built communities. And it's a real problem, right? I just want to really give that a lot of validation that that's a real problem. And we run that risk of that same thing happening here if we're not intentional about it. And that's why I always say we have to name the things that we're being intentional about. And so I think while it's good to have this general sense of mixed income, mixed use, I want to just kind of dial it back a little bit and think about what that does psychologically to that community. Because what it's telling that community psychologically is your community will only be valuable if you bring people in this community that either have a different skin color than you or make more money than you. Right. So if you want to support resources into your community, then we have to bring outside people into your community to provide those resources. So that's just a psychological impact. Like, well, why can't you just put resources into our community without displacing and disrupting our lives? So that's first and foremost. And I always want to highlight that because to me, that's probably the most important factor because it kind of contributes to generational poverty. Right. Because it's the mindset sometimes that can kind of keep you stuck. But secondly, there's a lot of barriers that happen if because you don't have control over your developers. And so really a lot of attention has to go to the developers that Blueprint 15 has picked. Because what has happened in other areas of, around Blueprint purpose-built communities is they start tying all these conditions on your return. So it is an automatic right to return, but only if you have a 620 credit score. It's an automatic right to return, but if you don't have a criminal conviction. It's an automatic right to return only if you haven't used your Section 8 voucher more than 3 times in 1 year. And that's actually what we heard in New Orleans around their purpose-built community, which is a very random and arbitrary kind of standard to say, if you move more than three times in 1 year, you no longer qualify and you don't have the right to return. Some purpose-built communities have said you have the right to return, but only if you work 20 hours a week. So what does that do to our senior citizens and our differently abled people, right? They don't work 20 hours a week. And that's probably why they're in affordable housing in the first place, to have some security because of their current conditions. So there's a lot of barriers that really get to the core of why it's really preventing the people who need the services the most from returning. So if you're living in public housing and you have a decent job, which a lot of them do, so there's a stereotype that people who live in public housing don't work, is simply not true. Over 70% of the people in that community have jobs, right? But there's what about the 30% that don't, right? And are we going to ensure that the people who need the housing the most, who are there now, have access to it when there's a new development? And that's where the real concern is. Are we creating a kind of nostalgia of lower working class, middle class Black people to interact with middle class, upper class white people, but then the people who are concentrated in poverty are now dispersed and kind of left on their own? That's the problem with purpose-built communities across our country. And I think because there have been 23 purpose-built communities, I hope that research has been done through Blueprint 15, and they are actively working on a way to make sure that does not happen again.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Lanessa Chaplin from the New York Civil Liberties Union. So just on some of those points, I spoke to Larry Vail from MIT previously in another one of these programs in this series, and he cited a couple things that government leaders and developers could do that would help based on his research to build trust, but also make the entire process more successful. One of them was guaranteeing a one-to-one replacement for the poorest residents displaced, actually putting teeth in what you just said there. And then also phasing in the new project. Don't do it all at once. So build a little bit and bring people back so that you can demonstrate that you are really making good on that promise. And that sort of will help build street credibility as you go forward. I'm just wondering if those sound like good ideas to you. And the other thing that I just want to throw in, maybe as a side note, but it is a light bulb that has gone off in my head as you and I have been talking, is that one option that could be out there, I suppose, is to refurbish and renovate the public housing that's already there. And you could certainly make an argument that it's due for that. And that could be one vision. Now that we don't have, I don't want to take you on a side note, but anyway, my point just is those two things that Larry Vail put forward, the one-to-one, a real promise of one-to-one and phasing in the project. Do those sound like good ideas to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think they sound like great ideas, but I do want to get back to your point of we're having this conversation about this community, but we're only talking about one option. And right. We're not talking about, there are several different options that we could talk about regarding how to revitalize this community that don't include displacement and disbursement, right? So let's just, I like that you pointed that out because that's a point that I try to kind of carry with me, that there are multiple options on how to revitalize this community. And what does revitalization look like to this community? And what does the betterment of this community look like to this community? Does it look like what Blueprint 15 is proposing, or does it look like something different? Like, and we won't know that until we actually engage and hear from them about what revitalization looks like in their community. So first, thinking about just communities and just transitions and just outcomes, we want to make sure that the people who live in that community are leading the decisions. And so if Blueprint 15 already has a plan, it kind of takes away an element of where we're leading this conversation to decide what we want to happen in our community with grant funding and other dollars that are used. But yeah, and I would also add to, I think Larry's point is displacement doesn't, think about displacement in a smart way. And people have lived there for a long time. Their kids go to school there, their kids' friends are there, their friends are there, their support systems are there. They might be walking distance from their job or the bus hub. So displacement can mean maybe keeping them in the footprint, like redeveloping, renovating houses that are currently in the footprint and giving them opportunities to own homes in that footprint or rent apartments in that footprint. So they're not moved across town and their lives are disrupted for 5 years. And then you come back 5 years later after they finally got stable again and said, hey, do you want to move into this great new neighborhood that we've created? So just thinking about how can we keep people in that footprint during the time of construction.
So I want to squeeze in one more question. We've only got about a minute, but I want to put you on the spot here. But one of the other things that Larry Vail talked about in my previous conversation when he was referencing Boston was the emergence of a local leader who was able both to authentically speak about the residents' needs, but also had the respect and the trust of people like the housing authority and the mayor, and was thus able to make sure in that instance that he was talking about that 70% of those residents were able to return. We've only got a few seconds left, but I did want to ask, is there a leader like that that's emerging in Syracuse? And maybe is it you?
I don't think it's me. I believe that the leader needs to live in that footprint, needs to be a resident of that footprint, and needs to be tethered to that community. So I don't think I'm the appropriate person to do that. However, I will stand behind whoever that person is and provide resources and help and assistance in the best way that I can under my umbrella for the work that I do. But yeah, I don't think it's me, but it's definitely, there's a lot of leaders in that community now that just need their voices to be uplifted.
We'll leave it there. That's an important point. That was Lanessa Chaplin. Again, to find a recording of the panel discussion that she participated in and that I've referenced earlier, search for City Scripts Charting Renewal. Lanessa, I want to thank you so much for making the time to speak with me, and I want to wish good health to you and your family.
Thank you. Same to you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Mark Levonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.